Hey everybody, welcome to the very first show of Ezra Interviews. That's really hard for me to say, everybody, because you know for years I've been saying, hey everybody, welcome to Open Mic with Michael Thiessen. But we're shooting our very first show under the banner of Ezra Interviews, and I'm happy to come to you today with a new author, Tilly Dillehay, and she is going to be sharing with us about her new book, My Dear Hemlock. So stay tuned. So I'm really excited to talk with Tilly today, but just before we get her on the show, I want to let everybody know that there are two important events coming up in the U.S. here for the Ezra Institute. First of all, we have Christ is King World Missions Conference in San Antonio, Texas. That is coming up January 19th to 22nd in 2025 in the new year. And closely following that, Joe and I will be at the Mission of God Denver in just outside of Denver, Colorado. And we are going to be there on January 25th. So look, folks, if you haven't registered for either of those events and you're thinking it's Christmas time, I'll get registered in the new year. We'd love it if you would just go over and register today if you are listening to the show and you're able to go. Lastly, I want to remind you that a great Christmas gift to your young adult is to send them to one of our Worldview Youth Academies. We're holding youth academies in Canada and in the United States. And we are going to be even developing one in the UK, hopefully for 2026. But these are great in-person, high-impact training programs for young adults. We bring in great mentors. We bring in a great volunteer staff. And your young adults will learn how to live with Christ as King in all the different areas of life. So with all of that advertising out of the way, Tilly, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to be talking to you today.
I'm so excited to be here and help you inaugurate your show.
Yeah, pretty special for you.
That's right.
It's been great. The show that I've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years, I basically try to get around the different topics that are important to Christians. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we're talking politics, sometimes we're talking medicine. You know, I'm going to be having one of our researchers on the show, one of our friends coming on in the next few weeks, talking about the increase of heart attacks among women in 2021 and 22. So we kind of go around the gamut, and I always love it when I'm talking to authors, particularly in the fiction category. So Tilly, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about your book, and so we can get to know kind of where your heart is with this and why you decided to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So My Dear Hemlock is a reimagining of the Screwtape Letters. And it's a reimagining with a female patient. And the voice of the demons who are involved, the kind of mentor demon and the younger inexperienced demon, they're kind of female voices as well. Or actually there's just the one voice, the person writing the letters, but I guess the idea is just what if we were to get, you know, another set of these letters, but it's the 21st century. It's a female who is, I think she starts the book as a new convert who has just been married. And you follow her as she is in her newlywed stage. She's kind of developing through her marriage, learning the Christian disciplines for the first time, becoming a mother. Becoming kind of a mature believer over time. And then you finish off with her when she's in her middle age. So it's probably like a 20 or 30 year span that you walk with the patient. So, yeah.
I have so many places that I want to go just from that introduction. So if I'm going to go in an area that you just don't address at all, don't be worried about that. But the timing of this book couldn't be more appropriate. And the reason why I say that is I'm thinking in the context of the doctrine of the infallibility of the woman that we are facing in the world today, you could almost rewrite a systematic theology book for heretics, and there would be a whole section on the doctrine of the infallibility of women. And yeah. particularly, I'm thinking of the Me Too movement, Believe All Women.
Yeah.
And just yesterday, I was listening to the news about a really important announcement of a 20-year-old case where a woman had accused a number of men of rape, and now 20 years later, acknowledged that it was all a lie. And in the context of her doing so, she actually acknowledged that she was trying to win the affection of man rather than the affection of God. And so without getting into her life any further, I wouldn't know, but it seems that the Lord has been at work there.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, yeah, for you to be writing a book that talks about the temptation of women, I would think that would be incredibly important. And one of the things to battle is this women are superior to men attitudes in our culture today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, I am a woman and I know what my heart is like. So the question of whether women are sinful has never been that interesting of a question to me. It just feels like a pretty open and shut case. But I guess, you know, this book, I've been interested to hear from men who have read this book and actually seem like they've learned some things about women, which has been something I wasn't really expecting. I was thinking more me writing directly to the hearts of women who are like, this is something I don't talk about. Other women maybe not even have learned to acknowledge these things, but these things are there. These are the kind of secret temptations of the heart. And that was my intent in writing the book, was to kind of air out those things for another woman to see, you know, this is what the forces of evil want for you in this season of your life. These are the kinds of things that they're actively encouraging in your heart, and they're real. So, yeah, I mean, the doctrine of the infallibility of women, it's hard to get behind that when you're a woman. I don't know.
Well, and so much of our world is about deception, right? And so that's why this would be such an important conversation, because young women, you know, I think a lot of this idea started with men writing sitcoms being willing to laugh at men,
right? Kind of taking the fall because of the laugh,
right? You don't write an entire sitcom from a male perspective that's just constantly beating up on women,
yeah,
because
right.
you think they're funny. Like every married couple in the world, you know that, you know, I think there was that recent YouTube video with the guy sitting there and the girl sitting there, and she's talking about her feelings and she's got a nail coming out of her head. And I don't know if you've no. seen this YouTube. Oh, it's no. brilliant. And she's just like trying to, you know, I've got pressure. I've got, you know, this, I've just got this issue. And he's like, well, I think it might be the nail. And she, of course, gets upset saying, you just like, always want to solve my problems. And so the reality of it is men and women are different. Mm-hmm. And we do often look at each other and we can either, you know, idolize the opposite sex, or we can, you know, vilify them. Mm-hmm. And I think this book would be instructive for both men and women, if you are writing from a perspective that's allowing people to see into the temptations that women face. It's interesting you said, I am a woman and I know the heart of a woman. That's actually one of the most important tools we have in giving counsel to other people, is just knowing the depravity of our own hearts. Jay Adams talks about this in some of his counseling books. And so if you're taking that approach, you're really helping people already to be able to receive good counsel. Now, Tilly, you're doing this in the context of, you know, you're a pastor's wife, you're a homeschooling mom, and you've written for other Christian organizations in the past. Let's talk about this in the context of, let's try to talk about this in each of those contexts. So, How is the book informed by your life as a pastor's wife?
Yeah. I mean, I've been asked before, are these like pastor's wife insights? Basically, you got this stuff because you have this special you know, material from being a pastor. I mean, maybe that's true. I've said, you know, there might be some things I've heard or seen because of Justin being a pastor, my husband. But, you know, I don't have a position in our church. I'm a wife who happens to be a helper to a pastor. And I feel like our church does a great job of preserving that distinction. So, this is really stuff that I got from being friends with other women and from being a woman myself and from now raising little women. I have three daughters, and only the one son. So I feel like I'm front seat to the little women problems as well. And the issues of the heart start real young. So, I do think there has been a lot of conversation leading into some of these letters, and they really run the gamut. There's so many different topics in this book. It was kind of a mess to write, honestly, because it just felt like, oh, I'm all over the place. I'm over here in marriage. I'm over here in friendship. I'm over here in eating and food. And I mean, it felt sometimes like, what's the unifying theme in this book? But
I hate the fact that I'm smirking, but isn't that the life of
it's a woman's
woman?
Mind?
Like a woman's mind. Yeah, it's everywhere, right. Multitasking, talking, absolutely, thinking about this.
Yeah, that does make sense.
So my wife is a pastor's wife.
Right.
And I can see that, like, just by journeying with me in ministry and being a great support in ministry, I can see that would be a tool to give you insight. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, again, in the context of counseling and in the context of trying to give people wisdom, that this would be a great help to them in that. In the area of homeschooling, did you write to homeschooling moms, or is the character broader than that world? And mm-hmm. how do you integrate that you're thinking about education mm-hmm. while you're writing a character that may or may not be doing that?
Yeah. You know, I didn't really specifically talk about homeschooling. There's a lot of, like, early child training. There's a chapter about early child training. I think that wasn't really my heart in writing this book, was to talk about education per se. I think a lot of it is just the disciplines of a Christian woman, and then a lot of marriage stuff. The parenting related stuff in the book is really ends up being kind of more of an overflow of the marriage material. And maybe that's because that's kind of my burden the last several years, has just been seeing women and just feeling like contentment in their marriages is one of the big kind of pressure points that I see again and again, is like a woman being happy in her marriage and how that affects every single area of her life. And I just feel like it's a bigger problem than it feels like it's a common issue. So, and that's the other thing of being a pastor's wife, you get to a point where you realize, like, if we don't have healthy marriages in our church, we can't have a healthy church. Every single suffering marriage in our church is a weight on the rest of us who are trying to make sure that everybody's healthy in the church. So just realizing this is kind of a ground zero issue. And I think a lot of women are kind of silent sufferers who are self-inflicting a lot of their issues inside of a marriage. So anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. I had two thoughts when you were thinking about that. First of all, for the guys listening, the requirement to be an elder, if you seek to be an elder, the requirement to be an elder is that you manage your home well. Mm-hmm. And I find it regularly, Tilly, as you've just mentioned, I find men coming to me saying, you know, I want to be a great leader. I want to influence. I want to impact for the world. What do I do? And the first thing I always say is, like, well, the training ground is the home. So shine in the home. Like, mm-hmm. It's just your training ground, actually, meaning mm-hmm. it's a ton of work. It's a mm-hmm. significant investment. But if you train well there, then you have the ability to lead in the church. You have the ability mm-hmm. to maybe being put into a place of authority and managerial power in a company or wherever you're thinking. But the training ground is always the home. So get that right. Like if you learn to treat your wife well, if you learn to lead your children and teach them, then you'll be a leader and a teacher of other people. But it doesn't go the opposite way. You don't become a great leader in the business world, or you don't become a great leader in the pulpit. And then learn to be a leader in the home. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. If we can have marriages and families that are pulling towards the Lord and serving the Lord, then we're going to see great impact out in the world. And contentment is a big theme there.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was thinking about when you mentioned the idea of contentment in the marriage and the home being such a powerful place for discipleship is how much we need to prioritize that. And so in the life of the church, this is an area that we need to call people back to, is the thriving family. And I know sometimes the life of the church can seemingly struggle because we reemphasize and we, you know, minimize our programs in order to highlight the importance of the home. And I'm sure you get to feel a little bit of that while you're homeschooling. So maybe talk a little bit about how this might be fruitful for homeschooling families in the sense that I just like to get to know people in their context. So
yeah, right.
You know, you're struggling with this as a homeschooling mom. So even though you don't address homeschooling, how does this help homeschooling moms?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it helps you to be happy in your life, then I think it helps you in the work that you're doing. But this book is about the fact that Satan sees a woman as a dangerous entity. You know, the hatred and rivalry between Satan and Eve is from the beginning. And the kind of work that a woman does is imminently dangerous to the forces of evil. Her childbearing. He hates her childbearing. Her making her home into like a military outpost for good and for truth and for beauty. This is her fighting against the forces of evil in her home. The teaching of children that she does through story, even like we're talking about fiction and the power of something like this. This book is not really fiction. It's a bunch of didactic letters about Christian living topics that are fictionalized in order to harness some of the power of fiction to approach a woman's heart in a different way. You were talking about sitcoms earlier and homeschooling. I just rediscovered a book when I was at McKay's last week. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this. It's a little picture book, The Singing Ringing Tree. And it's an old folk tale, but it's about a beautiful princess who is proud and she refuses every suitor who comes. And in the end, she ends up under this curse where her beauty is taken away basically until she learns to love. So kind of like a reverse Beauty and the Beast type story. But I read this book when I was a kid, totally forgot about it, stumbled across it, you know, at McKay's and had this sort of memory warp, you know, bought it for the kids and read it to my daughters just last week. And I was just thinking, How much of these kinds of stories that I was reading when I was a kid, you know, The Singing Ringing Tree, the Grimm's fairy tale about King Thrushbeard, where there's a princess who's too proud and she ends up being kind of taught a lesson by the virtuous prince, like the idea of fictional women who are, they reject a good man's love until they learn a lesson and their beauty and their kind of glory is returned to them. That stuff, like I read things like that as a kid. The idea of do women sin or are women sinful, it doesn't enter my mind as a plausible argument or question. And I think part of that is probably because my imagination has been formed by fiction through the years. And, you know, as a young adult, reading books like Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina, just these sort of instructive stories about women who get carried away by sin and what the outcome of those things are. I'm struck with the idea that the books that I read to my girls about womanhood even are going to be very important as we move forward. They certainly have been for me. So a lot of the categories that I work in now came out of books like, you know, this random picture book from when I was a kid, The Singing Ringing Tree. So fiction is so powerful to shape our hearts, as we know. And that's a big part of our homeschooling plan too. I mean, we're all about the fiction. So.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was thinking about books that we would hand out at our church for helping shape young minds, like children's books, like The Princess and the Kiss and The Squire and The Scroll are two younger children, books that we would hand out regularly. This area of fiction, so let's just explore this for a little bit. So first of all, within homeschooling, everybody, if you want your kids to be great at whatever, just get them reading. Like every educator on earth would say that, whether or not they actually care about doing that is a different thing. But as a homeschooling family and as a Christian family, you can just always put great books in front of your children. And there's lots of, you just go online and say great homeschooling Christian book lists. And moms like Tilly and other educating dads would have put together these great lists of just classical Christian literature that you can just keep putting the books in front of your kids or reading to them, of course, when you're young. So reading's a big deal. And it's a joyful thing when you're putting high quality books in front of your kids and it's filled with fiction. And why, of course, C.S. Lewis and we have Pilgrim's Progress from John Bunyan. Why these books are so influential is because fiction in and of itself just paints pictures that we see in our mind. Mm-hmm. And when we see something in our mind, so Tilly, I don't know if you guys did, you know, premarital counseling or if you've had any ongoing, you know, sharpening counseling sessions, but one of the most helpful things in a marriage is to just help your spouse understand what you're feeling by painting a picture. You know, when this happens, it makes me feel like, and if you can be careful and not just overly inflammatory, a careful picture, it helps people see things and everybody, that's what fiction does. So you can, you know, keep handing your children books is going to be great. And then as adults, this still shapes our minds. In fact, it can shape in a positive or a negative way. Tilly, what would be one of the most impactful images that as a fiction reader, not in your book, because I don't want you to give any spoilers away, would you say has been impactful in your life? Can you think of one relatively quickly about a fictional moment that has helped you learn a Christian theological point and apply it in your life?
Oh, goodness. That's a terrible question to ask. one moment in fiction.
Okay, well, I'll go first.
Okay.
I'll go first.
But I got one that rises immediately to the top. So I can grab that.
Okay, question.
Okay, you're right. Like, you got it. You got me.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay. The Perelandra. I love Perelandra.
We can have an argument about that one, but that's okay.
No. Well, actually me and Justin have the same argument regularly when we reread those books, because obviously being a man, I'm sure that Hideous Strength is your favorite of that trilogy. Being a woman, Perelandra is mine. And every man I've ever met loves that Hideous Strength. And I like it okay. Like, that's how I feel about that Hideous Strength. Like, it's all right. I will listen when he reads it to me aloud and I will tolerate it. But
Perelandra though.
Yeah. That's good. Perelandra. Well, honestly, it's not even a moment that has to do with the Green Lady. I really love the moment in Perelandra where Ransom eats the fruit and for those who are listening and haven't read Perelandra, this is not like a fruit, a good and evil fruit. This is not a forbidden fruit. This is a fruit that he's allowed to eat. But he eats this amazing, wonderful fruit on this other planet. And it's a transcendent experience. It's such an amazing fruit. He wants to immediately turn back and repeat that same experience by having more of it. And his conscience gives him pause to say, no, you don't actually have to turn back and immediately have that same experience again. That was enough. It would be like listening to an entire symphony over after you had just finished listening to a symphony. And there's a lot of conversation in Pearlander about that concept, the concept of time coming to you one wave at a time. You accept it and then it passes and you can't try to repeat it. So that has been hugely impactful for me in my life, just with, even with food, like with food and with other pleasures. The idea that God is sending you time at one moment at a time. And when it's over, you need to let it be over and move on to the next thing. So, okay.
That's fantastic for those of us who have very high expectations of like juicing the joy of every moment. Like I can name
Christmas,
like myself and Sarah, my wife doesn't struggle with this, but I struggle with this, and I can name one or two of my kids who struggle with this, where it's like, I got 30 things and I just wanted 31. And so therefore I don't enjoy the 30 things. And right. it's just like that. Oh, that was the best symphony ever. Okay. I want to go listen to another one immediately. Okay. Right. Wait a minute. Can we just take joy?
Yeah,
that's good. Correct me if I'm wrong, cause I haven't read Pearlander in a long time.
Stop it.
That's where he explores the doctrine of sin quite a bit. If I'm remembering that, or am I thinking of the first one?
I don't remember as much. Yeah, I don't remember as much about the Silent Planet and the themes. But in Pearlandra, you know, because Satan is tempting the Green Lady, and it's a sort of repetition of Eve in the garden.
Yeah.
You do get a lot of these just exploring what was the nature of her sin, like what was it that how did he get her? What did she want? And it's not what you'd expect.
So the explanation of sin being bent, I believe just a twisting of twisting of the norm was very helpful in that in that book. For me, the very first thing that came to my mind, again, it's Lewis. Lewis had such a sharp Christian mind. He's been so helpful for all of us, but it would actually just be the situation. The first thing that came to my mind when I asked you that question was just the moment of Edmund learning the lesson of being a betrayer and not being left in his total shame and his total destruction, but being redeemed and then seeing throughout, like we just attended the Horse and His Boy production up at the Ark Encounter. We live just 20 minutes south of the Ark Encounter. Oh man,
and they're stopping it, aren't they? It's like over now. I thought that they were discontinuing.
Well, it's a production company. I'm actually hoping my daughter will do some work with them, like go to one of their training times. And they rotate Narnia. So I think they're stopping The Horse and His Boy, and they might be moving on to Silver Chair or The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I can't remember. Okay. But all that to say, you see, even within The Horse and His Boy, a book later, and further on, you see Edmund continuing to be the character who has a level of maturity because he understands the depth of what it is to be forgiven. And so he can both be forgiving, but he is also more hesitant to rush into a moment because he's already done that. So folks, this is where fiction falls in. And so Tilly, you've written this book for women so that some of the veils might be peeled back from their eyes and they can see into the heart of the woman. How long is the book?
Oh, goodness. I don't know, 250 pages? I don't know. Do you mean it's 30 letters? I don't know how many pages it is.
That's great. Okay. So 30 letters over a span of 20 years.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, in some ways it is straightforward. I'm working straight off the imprint that was given, or the blueprint that was given by the Screwtape Letters, the older, more experienced demon with this sort of specific voice. In my book, it's more of like a kind of a catty, like a madame. I mean, her name is Madame Hoaxrot. And she, there's some kind of moments where she's just a petty woman, really. So it's not the Oxford Dawn voice that Lewis developed for Screwtape. But it's definitely you know, it's derivative. And then the 30 letters, that's how many screw tape letters there are. So I was just like, whatever worked for him, you know, is going to work for me here. But yeah, I mean, I think the first letter that I wrote was a letter about women who believe that they have married down. And it was a blog post. And I just was looking for a way to fictionalize something that I wanted to write a straight prose piece about. And this format kind of allowed me to do that. And then I continued with it because I kept thinking of other things that were difficult to write about outside of being fictionalized. And what's nice about reading through these things, I mean, there's a letter where she considers having an emotional affair. There are letters where she's learning to pray. She's never prayed before. There are letters about confessing sin to your spouse and to the other people in your life. There are letters where she's considering whether to develop relationships with godly women and learn from them in their well-run homes and their godliness, or to continue spending time with old worldly college friends, you know, which is pretty derivative of one of the screw tape letters, actually, where he's kind of got his foot in two worlds, and they both make him feel better about himself because he goes back and forth between them.
It's so normative anyway. of our human experience, both as men and women, especially in the age of social media, especially in the age where, you know, I'm completely off of Facebook. I have a Twitter account that's very dormant. I check it for news once in a while, mm-hmm. but like we're talking once every four months, or if someone says you have to look at this.
Yeah.
But if I were to restart up my Facebook account right now, mm-hmm. it would bring me friendships back from, right. you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And so what an appropriate letter for being focused on, for focusing your time and attention to the right area, rather than being tempted to just go back mm-hmm. and live in a social media world where mm-hmm. where your attention is divided and divided among competing greater or lesser characters, right?
Yeah, there's a whole letter that it's about. It's called About the Pocket Mirror. So the demon is explaining to this other demon what a smartphone is, basically. And it's a mirror that they carry in their pockets. That's like a Tony Reinke steal, I think. Anyway, but she's basically saying what social media does for your patient is it removes her completely from time. So it steals time from her in a way that nothing else does. And it actually allows her to live in time sort of the way we as demons do. I don't know that this is true, but I have this sort of imagination about the demon world that they are disoriented in time the way that a drug addict is, or the way that any person who's kind of strung out on sin. This has been my experience, you know, in my early days, that when you're strung out in the cycle of sin, you do tend to kind of lose a sense of where in time you are. Like how you sort of, you're impatient for where your misery to end, but you are not really sure how long it's going to be before that happens. You don't really know when you want time to fast forward to, because you know there's more misery waiting for you wherever, you know, if you were to watch a movie and lose 2 hours, you would still be miserable at the end of it. I guess that's just, it's my only way of understanding how demons are involved in an unwinnable war, is that they're disoriented by their sin, by the rebellion. Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. Do you know that, like, there is literally a Bible verse to support that idea?
Please tell me.
So it's interesting the way that you posited that people trapped in a lifestyle of sin have a tendency to be disoriented about where in time and space they are, right?
That's, yes.
I think you said it better than that, but that's my paraphrase of what you just said.
Yes.
That's literally the experience of Satan, the great dragon, when we see this picture in the book of Revelation where he has sought to destroy the Messiah, to destroy the child that is born, but the mm-hmm. child that is born in Revelation 12 becomes the king and is escapes up to heaven with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And there's this in Revelation 12, verse 12, it says, "Therefore rejoice you heavens and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short." And that has always struck me with the same idea that you were just talking about. Like, how mm-hmm. is it possible that the response of Satan is fury because his time is short, rather than
repentance,
right? Because yeah. the time is short. And yes. it is this disorientation of not understanding the depth and magnitude of our sin and to the extreme of death that it's leading us to, but mm-hmm. also like in that moment we don't see it. Like we are disoriented from the reality of how destructive that is. I think that's
right.
You know, I don't know if I could one for one, like, okay, that's the verse that proves right. Tilly's theory correct.
I think it's those are the kinds of verses I think that kind of have me, and just experience with sin and trying to understand the rebellion of Satan, you know, and his forces. Why are they in this fight? And I think it's like, you don't want to be miserable, but you're not willing to do what it would take to get unmiserable, you know. And I know my time is short, but I don't know when exactly it's going to be. And that's how you're able to kind of kid yourself into remaining in your rebellion, I think. So the connection, I guess, with the pocket mirrors or with the social media chapter was just, we the demons, we also experience time as kind of an amorphous space that we sort of float through. And when the human beings get on their phones and become avatars of themselves in the internet, they experience time in a similar way. So encourage this as much as you can for your patient. That's the way that letter goes. So
I love yeah. that. Look, the more and more we talk, the more and more I'm thinking, everybody, Christmas has just passed. Tilly and I are actually recording this just before Christmas, but we're not going to drop this until January 1st, until the first of the new year. This seems like a really great gift for the women of the church to go out. Might be a great book club. I wouldn't say Bible study because we're not mm-hmm. necessarily studying scripture, but go out and do a book club and then follow up with some Bible study about this. And so is that kind of your intent, Tilly, to get women talking about this and then digging into scripture about that?
Yeah, I've heard, so far there's been just a lot of feedback from women being like, this is a conversation type of a book. This is a really good, you know, together experience to read and chat. But the other thing is Canon created a really wonderful discussion guide that's available on their website, where they pulled verses to kind of go with these chapters and sort of salient points and discussion questions for each chapter. They did a great job. I mean, fantastic, better than I could have done pulling all that together. So that's a resource available as well.
That's great. Well, maybe a final, a final thing to talk about is, just the timing in the culture. And mm-hmm. so you're living in Tennessee. And so mm-hmm. we're kind of seeing this is how I was feeling about this morning. It seems like both in the United States and in Canada, there has been this experiment with the absurdity of cultural Marxism and the left and like particularly to women's issues, the expression of the Me Too movement, the experimenting of androgyny, all of these types of things. Where do you think this book might put them? Like if you're thinking about putting your thumb on the pressure point, mm-hmm. where do you think this book you might, where are you expecting this book to have the most amount of response as to, you know, it really pushes this, you know, on this pressure point of the culture?
Goodness, I don't know. Because I think it would depend on who's reading it. But I guess this book assumes that women are made to be in mothering types of roles, that they're made to be in homemaking types of roles. It assumes that a marriage is an arrangement of leadership and response, and that the woman is in that response role. So there's just a lot of things about, like, what makes a woman dangerous to Satan in this book is being a normal wife and mom in the church. Like, that's what it assumes about women. And that in itself, I think, is going to make it kind of a disorienting book to read for someone who's just not on that page at all. But I hope, I think what I really hope is that a woman who reads and she's not really in that headspace will read and start to really think about her life in terms of the long-term kingdom potential for doing ordinary womanly things in his name, and recognizing that, like, that is the space where you can do the most damage, you know, to the enemy camp and have the most glorious life, even though it's a quiet life and it's an unseen life. The woman in this book has a very ordinary life, and it ends in a very ordinary kind of way, but it's a glorious life because it's a life of growth in him and obedience. So
when we talk about the family, and I want to close the conversation about something that we talk about at the Ezra Institute a lot, and that is the concept of sphere sovereignty. And folks, when you're listening to Tilly describe the victory of a woman and the way that God has created her for a particular role, this is an area of conflict in the church today, unfortunately. And it's because we don't have this understanding of how powerful the family is to produce so much for the life of the kingdom. So we have tended in the past in the church to think that the church is the center of the church is the center of all things. Mm-hmm. And the family is this thing we have to put up with. And there's a conflict between the church and the family. And mm-hmm. folks, there is a little bit of that. And what I mean by that is that sometimes the desires of the church are not harmonious with the desires of a family, especially if the philosophy of the ministry of the church do not understand sphere sovereignty and the value of the home. Mm-hmm. And so often we will have pastors or directors of children's ministries or programs trying to do for the family what the family needs to do for themselves. Mm-hmm. A part of our problem of discipleship in the church is some women trying to do for other women what women need to learn to do for themselves. And if we think about the church and the family as two distinctive spheres that overlap, but need, I don't want, stay in their lanes is not the right word. They overlap because they influence and help one another, but they don't take over and consume each other. Then you can understand why authors like Tilly and why healthy churches would have a very high emphasis on the family. And sometimes people get threatened about that. They go, oh, wait, if I overemphasize the family, what happens if, you know, the family goes off of the rails?
Right.
Well, the answer is not to try to become the family. The church does not need to, you know, pastors do not need to become the fathers of all of the families of the church. No, pastors train the family in the pulpit, both the men and the women, so mm-hmm. that they can live on their own. So if the family goes astray, again, the response is to call the family back. So if a husband is going astray, you don't call him into some other role in the church to distract him from what he needs to do. He needs to become a better father. And in the context of women, we don't change the culture of the church to accommodate a whole bunch of women who are miserable in their marriages.
Right.
We call them to change the life of their home. And so, Tilly, I'm just so thankful that is your, you know, worldview and your perspective, that you're trying to empower women by your writing in this area, because it is so true, everyone. We, as a pastor, what Tilly said at the very beginning of this program about, you know, if there's a family that's struggling in the church, it's a strain on the whole church. And what you can't do is take over the family. You can adopt some people, like if the family just becomes so dysfunctional that there's only one or two of them left who want to follow the Lord Jesus, you can adopt them in to the life of the church and to the life of other families of the church to minister to them. But what you can't do is solve all of the family problems. So I love that you're calling women to that calling. I want to give you a chance to respond to that, and then I'll close us off.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is just so, that's so spot on to say, if a family is malfunctioning, the answer is not the church can replace that family necessarily. The thing is, like, when your family breaks apart, the pain of that is not something that you can pretend away. If your family is busted up, either your family of origin or the family you've tried to build with somebody else, a woman will feel that pain for the rest of her life. I think a man will too. So pretending that that's not the case is not going to be helpful, but, you know, doing everything possible to preserve the health of the family is a great action to take. The thing about me is I was actually saved through a family ministering to me. It was a church. It was a pastor and his wife who I came to their home to counsel with them, and watching this wife in her normal little country home domain was extremely impactful. It was part of the process that brought me to Christ and discipled me. I was discipled out here in this little town where I live now, by different families in the church taking me in when I didn't really have a family of origin that was in a great place at that time. So it was, to me, like, this is very personal stuff. The idea that the family is an evangelistic front line is not a theoretical idea to me. Like, that's real life to me. So, even the idea that there are people in the church who are single and don't want to be single, you know, or their families are busted up and they wish that wasn't the case. I do think that it's families within the church that are going to be the most helpful ministry units to bring them into those families. Because that just, it's a different level than being like, oh, well, there's plenty of church activities for me. That's still not a family.
And to that point, right? Like, even to your story, Tilly, the temptation would be, oh, I see all these families and my family of origin's not in a great place. Therefore, doctrine of family changes. And right. Now it's just about bringing everybody into church programming. It be you know, okay, one's successful, right. One's unsuccessful. But the point right. is that we're all together and we minister all together. So therefore we minimize family. And what you're saying right. is what you learned even in that process was how powerful the family is in right. its role within the life of the church.
That's right. Yeah. And I know
its role parallel to the life of the church. Yeah,
that's right. Parallel. And it's like, you don't try to bring the family down in order to make people feel better about the fact that they don't have access to that. You bring them in. I mean, I know that we have some words from Christ that I think people will take and run away with about, you know, he comes before your father, your mother, your husband, your wife. And that's absolutely true. But I just, there's no way you can't use those verses to do away with the power of a family unit that is walking, you know, walking with the Lord, a husband and a wife pursuing him. There's really nothing more powerful in my opinion than that. So
it's really interesting you say that, because this is something that we need to correct and just keep correcting within our culture. And that is because a godly family is a family by covenant, mm-hmm. meaning that you don't have a family that is functioning in a godly way, that is encouraging one another towards the Lord or even towards the goodness of this life, that isn't doing that by agreement, by a wife agreeing to submit to her husband, by a husband agreeing to loving his wife as he ought to love himself, by children eventually agreeing to honor their father and mother, and by parents, fathers agreeing to exhort their children, and mothers to teach their children. And so what people don't understand is that they get confused about the nature of a biological family. When Jesus was correcting his mom, when Jesus was saying, "Here are my brothers and sisters, those who do my will," it was a little jab to his family, going, you haven't quite got the picture yet. Mary, you pondered these things in your heart, but mom, like, it's people who are going to follow me as the King of Kings. And so even in those moments where you're seeing tension between the family, it's still Christ calling his biological family into being in covenant with him as their Lord and Savior. And so when a biological family is thriving, it is because they are a covenantal family. And we can have affection for one another, but actually our affections for one another will wane and even be destroyed if we don't agree to covenant, if we don't covenant to one another to be faithful and to walk in the ways of the Lord. And so the biological family does fall by the wayside if there is no agreement to walk with the Lord. But on the flip side, there's no degradation of that if this is a covenantal family walking alongside the church, but calling everybody within their family to follow the Lord. And as long as people are doing that, then they walk with great harmony and with great strength. And so we get all of those confused because, you know, actually, that's a big surprise. I think people have heard me say this on the podcast, but as a pastor who is in my late 40s, I would have never thought of how many friends in my late 40s I'm seeing walk away from the Lord because of their 25-year-old university students. I would have never imagined the amount of people who are walking away from the faith because they're following their biological child who has now or their adoptive child, whatever, the people in their home who are now walking away from the Lord. And instead of saying, "Come back," or saying, "I'm sorry, you're cut off for this disobedience and rebellion," they're actually following along with them. And, again, the solution is not to just create new programs in the church for wayward parents of 25-year-olds. It's to teach them how to call their children back to the Lord. Anyways, I'm rambling.
Wow.
So anyways, thank you so much for coming on and having the conversation.
Yeah,
everybody, I want you to be fully aware that in the United States, our Worldview Youth Academy is in Gatlinburg, Tennessee at Wafloy Mountain Village, not very far from where Tilly lives. So her entire church is going to come and join us. all the young adults there. That's July 11th to 17th this year. And you can register right now. Registration is open and we'd love for you to give this gift to your children. And of course, our Worldview Youth Academy in Canada is just across the American border, or just in Southern Ontario, in Port Colborne, Ontario. That's going to be July 20th to 26th. Registration is also open for that. That setting is on one of the Great Lakes. It's just a beautiful place. So register your young adults and give them the gift of a Christian worldview. Tilly, where is your book available?
I think it's on Amazon and other booksellers, and it's at canon.com. So okay. You can find it.
Perfect. Well, thank you for coming on, and everyone, thanks so much for listening. Godspeed.